From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard Magazine. Joining me on the show this week are Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for AlMonitor.com, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to National Journal. And here are the issues. An agreement to limit Iran's nuclear program was reached after 18 months of negotiations between Iran and six countries led by the United States. President Obama said rejection of the pact by Congress would inevitably lead to war. Republicans are nearly unanimous in opposing the agreement. In Athens, the Greek parliament approved strong austerity measures required to get a fresh bailout for Greece for 3 years from the European Union. And in Chattanooga, Tennessee, a 24-year-old gunman killed four Marines and a police officer. He was identified as a college-trained engineer and a Muslim who was a naturalized American citizen. Well, Barbara, you've talked favorably about the treaty with Iran for ever since I've known you. Now you have it. What is the significance?
All right. First of all, it's not a treaty. It's a political agreement.
What did I call it, a treaty?
You call it a treaty.
Well, I meant that loosely. Yeah, it is.
It isn't.
An executive agreement that the next president could eliminate if he wanted to.
The reason it's not a treaty is because, as you pointed out, that would require that would require congressional approval. Mm-hmm. And, of course, this does not require congressional approval. But it's much more than that. It is an agreement that's been reached between Iran and the international community writ large. It's between Iran, the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, and Germany. The deal is codified in a UN Security Council resolution, which will be unanimously endorsed very soon, and it will have the force of international law, which will set up an interesting situation for Congress. Are they actually going to try to vote against something that is already international law? And also sets up, I think, a difficult situation for the next president, if that president should want to walk away from this. It's a good deal. It restricts Iran's program verifiably for at least 10 years, stringent inspections, massive limitations on centrifuges, stockpiles of low-enriched uranium, reconfigurations of other facilities that were of concern. And in return, Iran gets sanctions relief.
Okay. Tom, what's your initial reaction? And then we'll ask about some of the specifics.
Well, I mean, it's a polarizing deal. Republicans, as you suggested, are almost uniformly opposed to this. Not all Democrats support it, but I would say a majority of President Obama's party supports it. It just depends on what's the most important thing. If you, as a world leader or as an American, believe that the most important thing that needs to be done vis-a-vis Iran is to make sure it becomes very difficult for them to get a nuclear weapon, a military weapon, you should feel pretty good about this at least for 10 years. But if you believe that giving them billions of dollars in debt relief by lifting sanctions will embolden Iran to threaten Israel, to fund to a greater degree of people who want to do Israel harm and who more terrorism around the world, you're not going to like it. So it's just going to pin. It's always interesting to me. We're not going to know, just like we're not going to know if George W. Bush was a good president or not a good president. History will decide, and it'll be a while. We're not going to know for sure. But if, as I said, the White House makes a pretty strong case that this, whatever else it does or doesn't do, it sets back the timetable for Iran getting a weapon.
Let's deal quickly with one thing, and that is what Congress will do. My view is most Republicans will vote against it, and almost all the Democrats, not just a majority, Tom, will vote for it, even though some of them now say, well, I don't know how I'm going to vote,
we're going
to look at it, and so on. You can see it falling together. And besides, if there certainly are procedural roadblocks like a filibuster in the Senate and the veto. The president said he would veto it. So Congress will spend a lot of time on it and then not block it or even attempt to. Would you agree?
Yeah, I do agree. Again, the way this has been structured, the UN Security Council approves this thing before Congress even really starts to debate it. So.
Yeah, why is that? Why not come to Congress first?
I'm sure that that was one of the things that they argued over well into the night in Vienna in the, you know, 2.5 weeks of intense negotiations that preceded this. Plus, again, this is not just the United States and Iran. It's mm-hmm. Iran and the international community. So we can't make this hostage to our Congress any more than Iran could say that their parliament had to ratify this before it would go through. It was deliberately structured this way.
I thought their parliament does have to ratify it, not that it's
no,
the same.
They're, in fact,
really,
the way the agreement is... way the agreement is structured, Congress doesn't have to vote on actually lifting sanctions for mm-hmm. 8 years. And the Iranian parliament doesn't have to vote to ratify something called the Additional Protocol of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty for 8 years. This is all done through executive agreements, presidential waivers, and action by the UN Security Council.
Tom?
I think the Republicans will probably vote out a resolution of disapproval. It's possible that there'll be a lot of huffing and puffing and nothing will come out of Congress. But if something does, since Congress is controlled by Republicans, the president's already said he's going to veto it. To override a veto would require a third of the Democrats in the Senate to break with Obama mm-hmm. on this. 34 Democrats, a third, about 12 Democratic senators would have to vote to disagree with this for that to happen. And it's hard to see on a matter of fundamental foreign policy that you'd have that many Democrats abandon President Obama. So I think the odds of stopping this are very remote.
Okay. What we're going to hear a lot about, and I'm sure, Barbara, you're ready for this, is the question of inspections.
Mm-hmm.
And President Obama says, well, we're going to have people there. It's 24/7. No matter what, we'll know.
Mm-hmm.
Can someone, an inspector, go and say, hey, I want to inspect this facility and then be able to do it immediately?
Well, in terms of the 18 declared nuclear facilities that Iran has, it is 24/7. There are already inspectors in the country going to the main sites every day and have been for some while. They also have remote monitoring, all kinds of high-tech gizmos. We had an event at the Atlantic Council, very interesting, with a former official in the Safeguards Division of the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is, of course, the organization that will be doing this work. And he described, basically said, it's not your grandfather's IAEA. I mean, he described the incredible increase in techniques that are now being used for monitoring programs like this. So I think it'd be very, very difficult for them to hide anything.
So inspectors can go and inspect when they want and wherever they want.
Well, they can, the declared facilities. When it comes to so-called suspect sites, if there are mm-hmm. suspicions that Iran is doing something it shouldn't be, then there's a process for gaining access.
Okay, we're going to stop now for a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Fred Barnes with Barbara Slavin and Tom DeFrank. Tom, you know, there's been a lot written, talked about by opponents of the executive agreement that take 24 days for a bureaucratic process for inspectors to inspect it.
Well, I'm going to defer to Barbara for the most part on this, but Secretary of State John
Kerry... You don't have to.
I'll just cite what Secretary of State John Kerry said in recent days. He said, in effect, it's meaningless because the nature of nuclear inspections are that, you know, you might be able to hide a piece of equipment, but you cannot hide traces of enriched uranium.
Mm-hmm.
And that basically inspectors can go into a site and they can tell pretty easily whether there's been bad activity there 5 years previous or 10 years previous. So it's a distinction without a difference, according to Kerry.
Okay. Yeah. Again, at this event we had, you can detect particles as small as a 1/1,000,000th of a gram.
Mm-hmm.
And the half-life of uranium is 4 billion That's B for billion years. So you can dig it up, you can move the soil around, but it's really, really, really hard. So 24 days compared to 4 billion years, I don't think that's going to be sufficient time for it. The other thing that bothers me about this argument, obviously you prepare for the worst, but Iran, having spent all this time, gone through all this pain and negotiated this agreement, you know, why in the world would they immediately turn around and try to cheat when it's going to take a long time for them to get the benefits?
Well, they do have a history of cheating.
But it's going to take them a long time to get the economic benefits of this. And one of the provisions of the deal is that if they are caught cheating, the sanctions snap back. So it defies logic. But even if they were to do so, the administration seems pretty confident. Nuclear experts seem pretty confident that they would be caught.
What about President Obama here? He said, and he's talked a couple times, he had a press conference, and then he met the press when he announced the agreement. He said that something has been achieved, something that decades of animosity has not. He seemed to imply that a good bit of that animosity toward Iran was on the U.S.'s part.
Well, I mean, I think that's fair. I mean, really, there has not been a relationship of any sort since 1979, when the American diplomats and soldiers and Marines were taken hostage by the Iranians during the revolution after the Shah fell from power. That's a long time. They, it took almost 2 years, right?
More than 444 days.
444 to get them released, and they weren't released
until
Ronald Reagan's first day in office, Jimmy Carter. First day as a former president. So there has been a lot of animosity, but I think kind of on a geopolitical level, this fits into President Obama's mantra. His basic attitude here, I think, is the same as towards Cuba. He's saying that it made sense to open up relations with Cuba because for 55 years, the hard line hasn't worked. This is certainly a different situation since Cuba doesn't have a nuclear weapon, but he basically believes that negotiation and diplomacy can solve a lot of problems. And again, it's going to take a while. It'll take at least a decade for us to know whether he was right or wrong.
One more issue, Barbara, that I'm sure you've thought about and will be talked about, and that is the proliferation problem in the Middle East. The Saudis, Turkey, Egypt, and other countries, and I guess the Saudis have been explicit about this, but others, it's been said anyway, they will feel if Iran goes nuclear, we have to go as well.
Yeah, well, I think there's going to be hedging. There's already been hedging. They'll have nuclear programs of one sort or another. But none of these countries have the infrastructure to do what Iran has done. I mean, Iran's nuclear program started in 1959, and the United States was the one that gave them the expertise to begin with. So I always call it the slowest moving proliferation program in history. The Saudis, you know, they make a lot of noise, but they are so entwined with the United States for their security and their defense against Iran's other activities in the region that it's really hard for me to see them actually trying to get a nuclear weapon.
Why do the Iranians want nuclear weapons?
They don't necessarily. I mean, why do you assume they do? You know, they have a program.
This could be a hard argument to make,
yeah,
to Barbara, on your part.
They have a program. They have a program. It's had a certain pattern. The Shah wanted them.
I mean, they have this vast program.
Wait a minute. The Shah wanted them. We helped him, right? And then there was a revolution in 79, and actually the leader of the revolution stopped the program cold for a number of years. It was only revived in the mid-late 1980s when Iran was in the middle of a war with Iraq, and Iraq was using chemical weapons against Iran, and everybody knew they were developing nuclear weapons. So Iran began this as a defensive deterrent kind of program. That was almost 30 years ago now, and they still don't have a nuclear weapon. If they wanted one,
as far as we know,
if they wanted one so badly, they would have it by now. So I think what they want is to the prestige of being a threshold nuclear state, but not the actual bomb.
Okay, Tom, you want to add to that, or should we turn to Greece?
No, time will tell. time will tell, and a long time before we know.
Greece, Tom, a bailout that the Greek Parliament, somewhat to my surprise, has agreed to, requires really strong austerity measures, very similar, not much different from the ones that the Greek Parliament voted against before.
Right, and the Greek electorate, by a 60-40 margin, 60%, 40% margin, decisively rejected. I think it is the Greek Prime Minister, Mr. Tsipras, figuring out that it was this or economic collapse. I mean, already with the Greek Parliament reluctantly agreeing to go along with this, Greek's banks are going to be able to open after being more or less shut down for the better part of a couple of weeks. The stock market has been closed for 3 weeks, and it will open. So austerity is the name of the game for the foreseeable future for Greece, but I don't think there will be an economic collapse and catastrophe. What I suspect is going to happen is that the government is probably going to have to call a new election by the fall, and we may see a new prime minister by early in the fall.
You know, Barbara, I think this puts the Greeks in an impossible situation. One, they really haven't gotten any debt relief, but there are things that a government can do normally if they were not in the eurozone. And I mean, you can, when you have a collapsing economy and you're in a deep recession, which Greece is in, you can devalue your currency. Well, they obviously have no power to devalue the euro, or you can do things with monetary policy and so on. They can't do them. I don't see how Greece is going to be any better off 3 years from now than they are now.
Well, I think the big question is how the debt is going to be restructured, you know, in such a way that Greece can actually repay it. And I would argue, actually, that the currency has been devalued. The euro has dropped significantly because of the Greek crisis.
Yeah, but not to the extent that the Greeks need. Anyway, we'll be right back with Issues in the News.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on the Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
Welcome back. I'm Fred Barnes with Barbara Slavin and Tom DeFrank. After that break, Tom, jump in here on the Greek situation. And Barbara doesn't seem to think it's quite as dire as I do. And I mean, I just think Germany and then the other large countries in Europe ought to take into account that you need some incentives to grow and manufacture more and become a stronger economy for Greece just aren't there.
Well, there are fiscal hawks within the eurozone, and then there's the German finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, who basically is, as some have called him, the angel of death vis-a-vis Greek debt.
I'm not objecting to that.
He's very hardline, and his attitude is tough medicine is required. Chancellor Angela Merkel has backed him up, and I think, as the New York Times said last week, the German tone has grown sharper, not more conciliatory, even after the Greeks have basically mortgaged their future for quite a long time. And I think pensioners are really going to get clobbered here. All the things that Greece has agreed to, privatization of some of their industries, all these things are going to take time. But I think Greece is going to take a tourism hit. I think there are a lot of people who are going to say, well, I don't think this is the year to go see the Parthenon. There's too much turmoil there. I think it's a long-term problem, and Greece will survive, but in a very austere circumstance.
Yeah, I guess what I've been trying to say, Barbara, is I don't think this austerity program serves the best interests of the European Union. And they ought to be, if they want Greece to stay in, they need to do more to help Greece be viable inside the eurozone.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. I mean, they have refused to give debt relief. What they're doing is they're going to restructure the debt and stretch it out and continue to give, you know, more bailouts here and there to the Greeks. But it still is better than the alternative, which I think would have been very disruptive. You know, Greece leaving the eurozone, setting a precedent for other countries to leave the zone. At least this way, it has some time to try to dig itself out from the hole.
Okay. Four Marines killed in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I think all four of them were at one of the recruitment offices that was firing by a gunman, and there was another one, too, that was attacked, but I think they're all at one place. What do you make of this, Tom? What, the FBI says there was one gunman. He was killed. He was a 24-year-old electrical engineer from a Muslim family, but one who had never been investigated by the FBI for any terrorist leanings or anything like that. This is really kind of scary because there was no reason to suspect that this particular individual was a threat to anybody.
Well, that's right, Fred. He was a naturalized American citizen. He went to high school and college in Chattanooga, Tennessee. He was not on any terrorism watch lists. The FBI is going through computer files before we know for sure, but at the moment there doesn't seem to be anything that suggests he was radicalized by social media, that may change. But this is, as you said, scary is the right word, because this is what counterterror officials have always said is their greatest fear. And not that somebody's going to pull another 911 terror attack that involves thousands of innocent victims, but the lone gunman, the lone radicalized gunman who can do something like this. I mean, military recruiting stations, which was the first place he hit, it didn't kill anyone there, but you don't even have to go through a metal detector to get through, to get into most military recruiting stations. And there was minimum security at the military reserve site where the four Marines were killed. And this could happen anywhere. I mean, this could happen in North Dakota or Alabama or whatever. And that, I think, is what has counterterror officials losing sleep at night, because this may be, and some officials feel like this is the likeliest form of terror against the homeland for the foreseeable future.
Well, Barbara, as you know, ISIS has called on Muslims around the world, particularly, to step up and kill American soldiers. There's no evidence that this was a response to that call, but what do you make of this situation?
Again, we really don't know enough about this young man's background, I think, to judge. I mean, I see him. Yeah, it's maybe related to what's going on in the Middle East, but I see him as another long line of angry men who kill people. And I'd put the man who killed nine worshippers in a black church, and the crazy guy who killed people in a movie theater who's just been convicted, and the young man who shot up children in a school. I mean, I see it as a problem of guns and people who are either mentally unstable or have other violent tendencies, more than I see it, frankly, as a political or an ideological act. Yeah, but we really don't know his situation.
We don't know yet, but those were not acts of terrorism when you go in and shoot up a school and kill a lot of innocent children.
Yes, those are acts of terrorism. My goodness,
what else would you call it? Means to terrorize other people.
If that didn't terrorize every parent on the planet, I don't know what would.
What may be different about this, Fred, is that the victims were military.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and there's been some social media where ISIS has said, "Try to do what you can. If you can't do much, go try to kill some soldiers or something like that." So ISIS has called for the military component, and I don't think. It's too early to know. I agree with Barbara, but I think we're going to find out that I don't think it was utterly coincidental that the four dead Marines were military officials, most of whom had served in Afghanistan.
Barbara, we have about a minute to go, and I'm going to give you a chance to talk about something you wanted to, the Republican presidential race.
This is your day.
The most controversial candidate is a man named Donald Trump, a rich guy who has actually drawn a lot of attention and upset Republicans. Democrats are glad to see him on the Republican side. What have you got to say?
Look, it's amazing. He is leading. I mean, admittedly, there are, I don't know, 3,000 Republican candidates at this point, but he is leading. He has 18% in the latest polls.
Yeah, don't take that too seriously. Still, Herman Cain was leading 4 years ago.
Still, 18%. I mean, Jeb Bush, who's, you know, the only sort of respectable candidate, is at 14%. So that tells you that his message is appealing to a certain element in the Republican base, and it's one that is largely old and white and racist. I hate to say it, but that's the fact. He says Mexicans who come to this country are rapists and drug dealers and killers. He wants to prevent immigration, you know, into this country. He has a sort of stream of consciousness style of invective that is really vile. And yet what is really...
It's called winging it.
What's really terrifying, frankly, is that most of the other Republican candidates don't seem to have the courage to denounce him for the things that he's been saying.
I think they have. A lot of them have now.
Well, and they certainly will if he gets into a debate. But he's an equal opportunity basher. I mean, in recent days.
And he has terrible hair. Can we add that?
Senator,
Thank you.
Well,
they criticize women for how they look. So,
well,
Senator John McCain referred to many of Trump's supporters as wackos, and Donald Trump referred to Senator John McCain as having graduated last in his class in the Naval Academy and then said, dummy. And so, I mean, he the only number that counts at this point, 16 months out, Fred, is the money number, because the amount of money will help determine how long somebody can stay in the race. I mean, Donald Trump is not going to be the Republican nominee for president unless the party is really bent on political suicide.
I'll have to say, with this back and forth about John McCain and so on, that has reduced the race to a level lower than I can remember at any time in particular. But anyway, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for AlMonitor.com, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.